Welcome back to the next session of this class on the book of Ecclesiastes, Searching for the Meaning of Life. In the last session, we concluded at the end of chapter 8, where we came across a stunning development in the author's perspective, where there was a clash between his methodology for how he was carrying out his investigation to try to discover the meaning of life, the big question as to what profit is there to all this work that goes on under the sun? And then what he actually knew in his heart, that there was a additional knowledge base outside of observational data that he was collecting. And those two were in conflict with each other. And so while the presumed author Solomon couldn't match the two, there was this tension where what he saw didn't comport with what he knew to actually be the case. And we're going to take another step today as we begin chapter 9, and we'll see that the tension continues to unfold. So if you have your Bible, turn to Ecclesiastes chapter 9, and we will begin in verse 1. Ecclesiastes 9:1 says, "For all this I laid to my heart, even to explore all this, that the righteous and the wise and their works are in the hand of God. People do not know whether it is love or hatred. Everything is ahead of them." So Solomon is beginning a new section here where he says he's applied himself. He's used this language before about like giving his heart to something. Here he uses the language, I laid to my heart. And he wanted to explore this subject. The righteous and the wise, looking at these categories, they're two words to define the same people group, basically, and what they do, their works, the actions, their lives, and that they're in the hand of God. So he's recognizing that God is having his hand upon their life and is involved in their work. But he says, his conclusion here is he says that people, these people, the righteous and the wise, and himself as an observer, doesn't know whether what their works are going to result in is love or hatred. Now, these are two words in the Bible that we in the modern world use love and hatred in very emotional terms. But in the Bible, love on one hand and hatred on the other, when referring to God or what is given to a person, is about divine favor, which is love, or divine judgment, which is hatred. It's not whether or not there's going to be this emotional affection or sort of this vehement disgust toward these people. It's whether or not they're going to receive favor or judgment as a result of what they do, the work that they do. It's an enigma. It's like something that Solomon cannot understand because, he says, everything is ahead of them. We've had this issue before where Solomon expresses he's disturbed about something because there's a limit to what people can know. There's a limit to what he can know, and that limit is the present. Because the future is a giant black box, unknowable, that it's hard to say what can happen in the future given a certain course of action. And he's circling back around to this premise here, that you can be righteous and you can be wise and you can have a life that is in alignment with those qualities, but yet it's unknown whether or not love or hatred awaits you. Why? Because everything is future oriented. He's now coming back to observable data here. He's looking at how do we know whether or not being righteous and wise is a good thing and results in good things. And he's saying, we don't know. We can't know because it would require you to ascertain the future in order then to draw that conclusion. And from his standpoint of his methodology, it's impossible. So it's confusing to him. It's an enigma. He doesn't know what to do with it. And now he kind of slides into starting here in verse 2, another familiar topic he slides into is about death. So he's looking to the future. And it seems that, well, everybody is going toward the same future. So he says in verse 2, it is the same for all, meaning the same destiny. There is one event to the righteous and to the wicked. So he started out talking about righteous and the wise people, but now he's talking about the righteous and the wicked. He's saying that there's this combination of not just being good and righteous, but now evil and wicked, and they're in the same boat. Also, to the good, and kind of leaves out here, I think what he means is like, there's also like the bad or the sinner here. To the clean and the unclean, to him who sacrifices and him who does not sacrifice, as is the good or the good person, so is the sinner. He who takes an oath, as he who is afraid to take an oath. This is just a series of pairings that Solomon uses to show that it doesn't matter which side of the fence you're on in these categories, one thing happens to all of them. One event, death. Everybody dies. So he's scratching his head then at, again, what difference does it make if you're righteous and you're wise? Everybody's going to die. The wicked and the righteous do. And you don't know if your good, righteous, wise acts will result in what you think they will. It could be love. It could be hatred. And so that's why Solomon then categorizes this enigma, this sort of confusion that he has as he's seeing everything. He calls it an evil, as we've seen before. It's when something is unexplainable to him. He can't grasp it. He can't get his hands around it and have the answer to it. That, to him, is an evil. It's not like a moral evil. It's just the Hebrew word refers to something that's bad, something that's negative. And so he calls it an evil. This is an evil in all that is done under the sun, that there is one event to all. And also, he adds on, the heart of the sons of men is full of evil, and madness is in their heart while they live. And after that, to the dead. Because he can't understand what difference can be discerned about being righteous or wicked, that everybody has the same end in trajectory in mind, this to him, it causes the conundrum that he's facing. But he also adds on, it's not just the eventuality of death for everyone. It's also that everybody seems to be kind of in the same way messed up. Everybody's hearts are full of evil. And I think here he's using this in a moral sense because he talks about the brokenness of the world. That's been a theme that's been recurring. And that even as wise as one might be, there's still wickedness in every person. And that madness is in their heart as well. So this is kind of reminiscent of another saying in the Old Testament from the prophet Jeremiah, that the hearts of people are completely evil. And that might be an overstatement, you know, that everybody's heart is completely evil, but it's that it's full of wickedness, that there is an abundance in the heart of people to do what is wrong. So Solomon is observing that this is what he sees in the world. And the problem is that if everybody is dying, he can't see what the profit is and why people would go through all the trouble to live righteously and to live wisely if in the end everything pans out to be the same. Moving to verse 4, for whoever is united with the living, there is hope. So he's coming off of this idea about the universality of death, and then he's going to relate it now to the advantage of being alive. If you're united with the living, which is just a way of saying you're alive. So if you're alive, there is hope. For a living dog is better than a dead lion. He's now looking on the positive side of that. Well, if you're dead, there's really nothing else for you. You're dead. But if you're alive, there's hope. Hope for what? Anything. Basically anything. That if you're alive, there's still hope that something can be done. And that you're able to actually do something. Because when you're dead, as he's going to go on to explain, you're in a whole different circumstance where you got nothing. And that's why he says here in this better than comparison, a living dog is better than a dead lion. And what he's just trying to say is something alive has more value, no matter how small it is or how undesirable it might be, which in the biblical culture, dogs were not friendly animals, and they were looked at as very unclean. They were despised by society. So for him to say a living dog, it would be in our world maybe like saying a live sewer rat is better than a dead lion, something along those lines. Now, why is the living dog better than the dead lion? The living, he says, they know that they will die. That's in the future, as he's been saying. But if you're dead, the dead do not know anything. They don't know that they're dead because they're dead, nor do they have any more wage, meaning like there's nothing left for them in the living because they're not there anymore. They can't earn any more wage. They can't do any more work. There's no attempt at any other profit for them by what they do under the sun, because when you die, you cease to exist. He even amplifies it further and says, even the memory of them is forgotten. This is a little bit of an embellishment, because after somebody dies, it's not like nobody remembers that they used to be alive at some point, but just that the permanency of the idea that their memory will carry on forever, essentially, that he's destroying. Because eventually people's lives and the memory of them, they fade into the background of history. That's his essential point, is nothing lasts forever. Furthermore, their love and their hatred and their envy have already perished, and they do not have any more a portion forever in anything that is done under the sun. He's just trying to drive the point home here that the dead are empty-handed. If they were loving, or if they showed hatred, or if they were envious, or any other of these actions and behaviors, they're all gone. It's all in the past. And they don't have any other portion. Now, portion, this is the word that Solomon's used time and time again to talk about the work and the assignment that God has given to humankind. And that from that portion, people are going to be able to receive the benefit, the fruits of their labor. And that is part of the gift that God has given to humankind, Solomon has said. And if you're dead now, you no longer can participate in that. He's drawing a very sharp distinction here between the value of what you can do because you're alive and the nothingness that you get or that you have when you're dead. So that concludes this section that he focuses on death, essentially, the universality of death. And then he talks about the advantage of life, but he does it in contrast to being dead and to prefer being alive, because there's hope that something can be done. There is a future yet unwritten that you can be part of. Now, in verse 7, he begins another section, and this section is different. This he turns toward what is known as the Carpe Diem passages, where we've seen, this is the fifth one, actually, that we've seen in Ecclesiastes. I believe it's the fifth and final one. Here Solomon says, go and eat your bread with pleasure and drink your wine with a merry heart, for God has already accepted your works. Let your garments always be white, and do not let oil be lacking from your head. Enjoy life with the wife whom you have loved all the days of your pointless life that he has given you under the sun, all your days of pointlessness. For that is your portion in life and in your labor in which you labor under the sun. Unlike previous times where Solomon has advocated for enjoyment of life, here he actually states what he wants the reader to do. Now, I want to just look briefly at those previous Carpe Diem passages to show how there's an escalation throughout Ecclesiastes as we've progressed. Solomon has been expressing these ideas in more and more forceful terms, unto the point right now where he's actually instructing the reader. So back in chapter 2, in verses 24 and 25, it says, there's nothing better for a person than that he should eat and drink and make his soul enjoy good in his labor. This also I saw, that is from the hand of God. Who can eat or who can have enjoyment apart from him? Solomon couches it in the perspective of a better than structure, that it's there's nothing better, he says, than this. And this is his perspective he's sharing. He does the same thing in chapter 3. I know that there's nothing better for them than to rejoice and to do good as long as they live, and also that each one should eat and drink and enjoy the good resulting from all his labor. This is the gift of God. Again, he's sharing his perspective on a value system of what is better than this. There's nothing better, he says, than to rejoice in the good that you do as long as you live, and to eat and drink and to be merry. Now, from the better than structure, he moves in chapter 5, as we've seen, that he talks about his perspective from what he actually observes, not from his mental perspective, but this is what he sees in the world and his conclusion he draws, that what I have seen to be good, this is it. It is appropriate for one to eat and to drink and to see all the and to see good in all his labor in which he labors under the sun all the days of his life that God has given him, for this is his portion. Every man also to whom God has given wealth and riches and has given him power to enjoy them and to accept his portion and to take pleasure in his labor, this is the gift of God. So from the better than structures, he's now moved on to his observations that he's sharing, to the next passage that we just read in two sessions ago in chapter 8. He now goes from just observing and sharing that to now giving some advice, a recommendation. So he says, I recommend the enjoyment of life in chapter 8, verse 15, because a man has no better thing under the sun. So he does include the better than structure here, but it's on the terms of his recommendation. And so because a man has no better thing under the sun than to eat and to drink and to be merry, and that will accompany him in his labor all the days of his life that God has given him under the sun. So that brings us to the current passage where we see he now says, go and eat your bread with pleasure. And he expands it here and uses even more descriptive terms. Eat your bread with pleasure. And he says, drink your wine with a merry heart, for God has already accepted your works. Now, this phrase here, God has already accepted your works, isn't some universal label upon God giving approval to anything that people do, no matter what it is. This is that within following God's ordained structure and intention for life and the work that he has given to humankind, God approves of that. And then also from that, to enjoy the fruit of that labor as well. This is the gift from God that Solomon says. So that is, God has accepted those works for you to eat your bread with pleasure, to drink your wine with a merry heart. And then also not just enjoying the consumption of goods, but he's now going to focus on attire. It says, let your garments always be white. In the biblical culture, white was a color that indicated joy and festive attitudes and positivity. In addition, do not let oil be lacking from your head. Oil was also part of celebratory events, and it was good for your skin in the hot and dry culture of the Near East. In verse 9, he talks about enjoying life, but he does it now through a marital context. Presuming that a person is married, he says to enjoy life with the wife. Now he's taken a kind of a male-centered perspective here, which is common for biblical literature. Enjoy life with the wife of whom you've loved all the days, your pointless life that he's given to you under the sun, all your days of pointlessness. It seems like he loves to kind of just harp on this idea of he can't understand life, and therefore he doesn't know what it's all about. So it's all pointless to him right now. He's still in the midst of his journey, but he just kind of sees that just enjoy life, even if there's no answers outside of that. If there's no answers to the ultimate questions, still enjoy life. That's his advice here. And it's not really just advice, it's instruction. But it doesn't stop there. And verse 10, he concludes this Carpe Diem passage of saying kind of like, just enjoy the moment with this statement here in verse 10. Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with your might. For there is no work or planning, or knowledge, or wisdom in Sheol, where you are going, as is everybody. He's looking to encourage work, hard work here. It's not just enjoy the fruit of the work, but he's mindful here to encourage work in a certain way. work with an attitude of diligence. Whatever your hand finds to do, that's just a way of saying whatever task you are investing yourself in. The hand is just a representation of activity, the metonymy for doing something here. Whatever your hand finds to do, whatever you're involved in, whatever activity, whatever the category of work you are doing, do it with your might. Do it with your physical might, and also do it with your mental might as well. Apply your whole self to it, he's saying. Why? Because in this moment, you're alive, there is hope, because down the road, you will die. And he comes back around to this idea of the vacancy in the grave, that death holds nothing for you. There's no work, so whatever you're doing, it will cease. There's no planning. Everything you think you're going to do, you never will. There's no knowledge. Whatever you know, you've lost. And there's no wisdom. You can't choose right and wrong in Sheol, which is a Hebrew reference to the grave. So people who die, they go to Sheol. It's the place of the dead in the biblical custom and understanding. So he's saying this is where everybody's going. So while you're alive, make the most of it. That's what carpe diem is. You know, be in the moment, seize the moment. Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with your might. Then moving on to verse 11, he changes. So that was the end of a section here. As we see, he begins here in verse 11, I turned and saw. Common phrase we've seen before. This indicates that he's starting a new address or a new section. He's going to talk about something different. Then I turned and saw under the sun that the race is not to the swift, nor is the battle to the strong. And also the wise do not have bread, nor do people of understanding have riches, nor does favor come from people of skill, but time and chance happen to them all. So here he's going through, and I think he does, we got one here, the race, we have the battle, we have being wise, we have people of understanding, and we have people of skill. He gives five examples of what he sees to be an inversion of what is expected in reality. This is part of what his enigma is about life as he looks around the world, and he sees things not in the way he expects to see them, especially if he thinks that everything's supposed to work according to this ordered paradigm by God, because he sees the race is not to the swift. Well, if I ask you, who wins a race? You would say probably the first person to cross the finish line, and that is the fastest person. So for the race to not be to the swift, that's an inversion. It should be. The swiftest person does win the race. Likewise, the battle to the strong, if you have two people fighting each other and one is half the size of the other, you expect that the stronger person is going to win the battle. But he's saying that's not the case. Also, the wise do not have bread. Well, according to traditional wisdom, if you're wise, then you will be able to be prosperous. You will be successful. You will have food. You will not be in poverty. Nor do people of understanding have riches. This is also part of traditional wisdom that to be successful and prosperous by being wise means that you will become wealthy. Wealth is brought by making good choices through wisdom. He's saying that's the opposite here. Also, nor does favor come to people of skill. Usually people who are really good at what they do, people like that, they're good at it. They get favor. And if you're a businessman and you're skillful, that brings more business. People like to have a competent person doing the service for them. Now, why is he putting all of these inverted realities and stacking them up against each other? At the end here, he tells us, from his perspective, time and chance happen to them all, and that's why they can be inverted. His point is that it doesn't matter if you have all these great qualities. It doesn't matter if you're the fastest, the strongest, the wisest, the most understanding, or the most skillful, because time and chance happen to everybody. Therefore, by being any one of those qualities, that doesn't guarantee that you're going to have the outcome you think. Time and chance here refer to the occurrence of disaster and adversity in one's life. And this goes back to chapter 3, which talked about the way that there's a time for everything under the sun. There's a time in which bad things happen. There's a time in which disaster strikes, tragedy strikes, You enter into adversity that was unforeseen, and therefore circumstances do not turn out the way that you predicted or thought they would. So that's why reality can be flipped upside down on its head, because the randomness of life can allow for unpredictability. And this is part of an explanatory framework that Solomon is offering as to explain why things don't seem to work out the way one might expect they would. He goes on to affirm also in verse 12, indeed, a man does not know his time. This is referring to the time of death, does not know when his time will come. Like the fish that are taken in an evil net, like the birds that are caught in the snare, even so are the sons of men ensnared in an evil time when it suddenly falls on them. These two negative illustrations of a fish being taken in a net or a bird caught in a snare, these are ways that Solomon is describing how disaster comes to a person. It's like being caught in a trap, he's saying. And that happens to everybody. All the sons of men, they get ensnared at some time in an evil time, he calls it, because it's a bad thing. It's trouble when it just suddenly falls on them unexpectedly. It's an evil occasion as he sees it. And then in the last section in verse 13, he switches to, again, another section by seeing in this what he's seen. In all this, I have seen. This is sort of like a conclusion. He's seen wisdom. He's seen people with wisdom under the sun. So like around him on earth. And he says, it made a great impression on me. That's interesting, Solomon. Why is that? He goes on to give a little anecdote here on why he sees this wisdom and made an impression. He says, there was a little city and few people in it, and a great king surrounded it and built great siege works against it. But there was found in it a poor, wise man. And by his wisdom, he delivered the city. Yet no one remembered that poor man. Then I said, wisdom is better than strength, but the poor man's wisdom is treated with contempt and his words are not heeded. Let's pause there. So this little anecdote he uses as an illustration to show wisdom that he has seen, whether this is fictitious or real history, he doesn't really tell us. But let's just take it as a case here that there's a small city and some king, a great king with an army, comes to conquer the city. But because there is a poor man who has wisdom, that city gets delivered. Hooray! But it doesn't turn out the way Solomon thinks it should. That poor man, because of his wisdom, doesn't get recognition. Nobody remembers the poor man. And not only that, he says in verse 16 here, this man, this savior of the city, is treated with contempt and nobody listens to him. Now, this is post-deliverance. This is after the city is rescued, most likely, Solomon has in mind here, is that everybody looked at the poor man and didn't treat him the way they should as the one who just delivered them from the hand of the enemy. Also, people might have listened to him in the moment of crisis when they were under attack and being sieged, but now nobody listens to him. He doesn't understand why that would be the case. The man has wisdom that did a great thing, and then people scorn him and ignore him. This had a great impression on him because if this is the way wisdom works, it would then imply the question, well, what good is it? What good is it to be wise if this is the way things turn out? If you're a wise person, you then become the object of people's jokes. You become contemptible in the eyes of people. But he comes here at the end and he offers some actual words of wisdom here. He says that the quiet words of the wise should be heeded rather than the shouting of a ruler among fools. Wisdom is better than weapons of war, but one sinner destroys much good. So he knows that people really should be listening to the wise poor man, but in reality they don't, and that a ruler can raise their voice but be among fools and get nowhere. And so because the wise person delivered the city because of his wisdom, wisdom is better than weapons of war, which is kind of harkens back to verse 16, that wisdom is better than strength. Better to be wise than to have a big army. That's the wisdom that Solomon's presenting. However, he says, one sinner destroys much good. So in his question about the value of wisdom, the implication here is that if wisdom is so great and so powerful and brings such strength, then how can one sinner bring it all down? There's a modern saying that we often use that one rotten apple spoils the barrel. The idea here is the same, where there can be a small bit of evil, small bit of wickedness, one sinner among all these other people, and there can be disastrous effects because of it. And since one sinner can bring so much, can wreak so much havoc and bring down the strength of wisdom, it implies that Solomon's questioning, what is the real advantage of wisdom if only one person can destroy so much good? He's going to continue this thought in chapter 10. We're going to take a short break, then we'll start back in chapter 10.